My name is, hard to say what my name is. It's Moose. I was in a New York City Yabasa Collective a few years ago with a bunch of other people. We did some things, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, we're going to talk about that later on. So, there's a new sort of Yabasa Collective group. Called the Orange Overalls, or the New York City Yabasa Overalls, or whatever, and Andrew Carter are part of that as well. And so they're going to sit in, be a part of the panel and discussion, and maybe hopefully add a significant number of thoughts to the discussion. There's a pamphlet going around. Hopefully, have that. This is just some primer, theoretical ideas with introduction. Together by, I don't know who that is, but I got this in the mail, little birdie dropped them on my doorstep, and so this is actually the first time I've ever given this workshop to a large audience other than Crystal. And I have a little PowerPoint presentation. Unfortunately, we don't have a projector, so you have to bear with me. With some pictures, and we're going to see a little bit of video, and and that's it. So you want to say your piece?
I'm Carter. I am part of the current sort of incarnation of the Yabasa collective-ish thing. I'm also a street medic. And
I'm Angie. Participated in the most recent Yabasa action. And I am a dog walker for the rainforest. And make buttons. I make buttons and t-shirts with Can't Afford Buttons. Should we just go down?
Yeah, quick introduction so we get an idea.
My name is Matt, and I work downstairs for the War Resisters League.
My name is Luke.
My name is Adam.
Jim?
I'm Brian. Matthew with the New York Metro Alliance of Anarchists.
Joni.
Carrie.
Joe.
My name's Tal. I'm with the Meerkat Media Collective, and I also participated in the Give Out to Action. And I hope it's okay. Is it okay if I'm filming? The NAS?
And my name is Jason. I lived in New York the last 4 years, and then just moved down to Philly August. And in this one is because I've been reading a lot of Italian social political theory, Negri, and all those guys, and so I'm familiar with White Overalls kind of people work, but I'm really interested to see what it's actually like being there on the ground. So.
Hi.
Hi.
So, chairs back here. Okay. We're just having quick introductions. So maybe you want to say your name and if you're from New York or any affiliation or
anything. My name's Rach. I'm from New York. I live in Queens. And I'm here to learn.
I'm Kate. I'm from D.C. I'm definitely here.
See you. All right, so I'm going to, this is called Protest Tactics and Disobedience Strategy. Lessons of the Italian Tutte Bianche White Overalls Movement. Tutte Bianche meaning white overalls in Italian. I'm going to hit the space bar now, and it's going to advance the PowerPoint presentation. Awesome. Precursor, can everybody see this, kind of? Sorry, we don't have a projector. Precursors. Okay, so I'm going to go through some images. So, I'm just going to see the images. Yeah, maybe it's because I want to just a bit. Just take a look at the images and get an idea on what came before. And this is historically worldwide and all that kind of stuff. So, okay, so this you're going to see a little bit more of this later. You're going to see actually a video from this. We got it. That is GI resistance in the military.
What?
That's, I believe, in 60. 66. And having some sort of sit-in. Civil Rights Movement, Selma, Alabama. That's the bridge. I can't remember the name of the bridge. Colvin Bridge. Famous bridge they're trying to march across. Everybody knows that. Weather Underground. Locos. Autonomen, German Autonomen. Notice the helmets, black helmets, tight formation. This is in 85 maybe. Tree Action, the tripod, that's in England. This is an ACT UP demonstration in New York City, I believe the foot of the Hudson Tunnel in 87. Famous image. We're going to come back to this image. That is in a small village in Chiapas. Mexican army. Anybody see that? Okay. Anarchist Black Bloc. Okay. So concepts. Okay. So what you just saw is basically just a run of various selections of different street confrontation and manifestations that have happened over the years. Also, a few ideas regarding civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience throughout histories and such. So, with that notion in your mind, I'm going to talk about briefly the history of the Tutti Bianchi, the Italian movement that developed in the mid to late 90s. Primarily, it's real. The focus city initially was Milan, and a social center called Leoncavallo. Leoncavallo is this huge social center. It's like a squat. It's a huge squat. It's a community center, huge space. But so that's where we're gonna go start. So to paraphrase a long history of particular Italian social and political movements, the 80s in Italy witnessed sort of a political firestorm of criticism regarding the 70s, the 60s and 70s. Now in Italy there was a continuum from the 60s through the 70s in political movements and developments, left-wing political movements. If you're familiar with the various workers' power ideas, I'm not going to really go into those. But over here we had a lot of we have Students for a Democratic Society, and we had workers' struggles going on, for instance, in the plants in Detroit. In Italy, the level of resistance and activity was much greater, and it went all throughout the 70s. So here it subsided in the early 70s, and things really kind of tanked at that time. But in Italy, it went on until the late 70s, and in the late 70s, there was a series of actions by the state, the Italian state, to basically quell these activities. And through these state situated, if you could say, counter-revolutionary activities, the movements of the left were given sort of an ultimatum. They had to ask themselves, okay, what went wrong, and why did it go wrong, and how can we successfully deal with those lessons? And so what happened is the social centers started to develop in the 70s and 80s, and social centers all throughout Italy, in cities like Rome, Padua, Genoa, Milan, Trieste, social centers were developed, and they were basically kind of like squats, the way New York City had squats. It would be an old abandoned building or factory, and youth or unemployed or activists or revolutionaries would take it over and run a community center. And so in the 70s and 80s, a lot of the social centers started to pop up, and one particular social center was called Leoncavallo in Milan, as I mentioned. Now Leoncavallo was initially, it was situated in a small, sort of brownstone-ish type building, but eventually they squatted an old factory, and they turned it into a community space with concert space, and it's huge, immense. And they would have very occasionally Italian movement meetings and conferences there. And so Leoncavallo was a center in Milan, just like other social centers in other cities in Italy, centers of activism, of discussion and dialogue. And this is really outside of the institutional left. Now, the institutional left in Italy represents, of course, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, in some facets, the refounded Communist Party, which maybe you know how to say, it's a, sort of a break-off of the Communist Party called the refounded Communist Party, and they organize slightly different principles. So you had the institutional left, and a lot of communists were in government, city council, they had a parliamentary bloc and all that kind of stuff. So we're really, the social centers were the focus for the extra-parliamentary left movements. So anarchists, small-c communists, some Leninists, you run them activists, some NGO-type organizations, civil society, even though they weren't calling it that then. Okay, so to make a long story short, various movements in the 90s were starting to be fueled, particularly by the Zapatista uprising that happened January 1st, 1994. So Zapatista, of course, the uprising was sort of the shot heard, the real shot heard around the world. We talk about the Eros effect. You know, that movement and the subsequent organizing that went into that was really was an inspiration for a lot of groups around the world. And Italy, they took a major cue from the Zapatista uprising. Within a year, there was an association called the Abbasid Association. And it was essentially a Chiapas support network, the Zapatista support network of Italy. But they also incorporated a lot of other groups that were doing pro-immigrant rights activism, and a lot of groups centered in the social centers as well. And there was a movement that developed called the European Counter Network, and in associated with the Abbasida. So there's all these different networks developing. When the Zapatistas called for the first Encuentro for Humanity Against Neoliberalism, which took place in Chiapas, I believe it was 1995, the Italians sent people from the Abbas Association. So they started making these ties. And they also started to utilize some of the language that the Zapatistas were using, particularly Marcos's writings and ideas and notions of that new sort of language coming out of the Zapatista uprising. So, okay.
Kimbasta roughly translates to mean enough already.
Right.
It's supportive.
Right. So, okay, so then, so all of these movements, similar to here, all of these movements, they're starting to call it the anti-globalization movement, are starting to develop and initiate and activate, and, in Italy at the same time, around 94-95, in Milan, they had a right-wing racist mayor. He was part of the Northern League, and it's a political association of essentially neo-fascists in Italy. And Berlusconi has close ties to this. So the mayor, as soon as he got elected, he threatened to shut down Leoncavallo, and within 6 months, he sent in the Carabinieri to shut it down. And as a result, there was a huge march, demonstration with 25,000 people. And his remark when he shut it down, and this is going to segue us into the actual movement, his remark in shutting Leoncavallo down, which again is a focal center for a lot of Italian resistance, left-wing resistance, was, now those squatters will be ghosts, to that effect. So they took it literally, or they took it ironically, and then decided to start showing up in these white overalls as ghosts. Now there's a double entendre as well. The white overall, they took that as a cue, but the white overall has been this theoretical discussion in Italy for about 15 years about the nature of work and how work is changing. So no longer are the old struggles of, you know, the workers of the world unite in the factory, taking over the factory, all that kind of stuff. Now the issue is in immaterial labor. Maybe you guys can, y'all can talk about this a bit as well. But so immaterial labor, and a lot of these ideas are coming from Negri and some other Italian autonomous writers and thinkers, autonomous Marxists, meaning they're within the Marxist tradition, but they're not tied directly to any institutional Marxist political structures or machines. You know, they're not communist party apparatchiks or anything like that. And there's a tradition in Italy of this. So the they counterpose the tutte bianche, the white overalls, with the tutte blu, which is the blue overalls, the classic working class. And the tutte bianche is the immaterial, or the precarious worker. And so that's part of the language. Okay, so for about 3 years, the Milanese, Leoncavallo activists, and a few other activists started to wear the white overalls around here and there.
Can you see the door button?
The one on the left.
Can I say one thing about the whole thing? So, and I think the other thing that's sort of significant, you know, Moose was talking about folks really taking a lot from the Baptistas and the concepts, and I think the white overalls piece is also a really big part of sort of A, white being like the sum of all colors and things like that, but also creating some of the similarities around the Zapatista movement of like non-hierarchical structures in which we are all sort of look the same and are all the same, right? So that it could be any of us. And so I think that sort of dressing and signaling of very clear intent around mirroring some of that ideology coming out of the Zapatistas is really important.
So the Leoncavallo action was in 1994, and that's the first instance the white overalls were donned, and it took 3 years for the notion of the turtle shell tactic to develop. So before I get into that, let me talk about the white overalls. So basically you had these groups, the Tutte Bianche groups, and they decided to adopt an identification of tactical concern. So that is, they were Yabasta association groups. So for instance, the Rome Squatters Collective, okay, were part of the Yabasta association. And they decided to adapt the Tutte Bianche tactic. So when they would go to a protest, they would wear the white overalls. So they weren't actually part of the Tutte Bianche group or collective or association. It was simply a tactical consideration. It's sort of how black blockers in this country, or if you just go to a random protest, you're not a part of the protest organization. You're a part of your particular organization, and you happen to come out. Okay, so your identity isn't folded into Tutte Bianche. Tutte Bianche is just a notion that you use in order to subsume your identity for a moment, in time, a manifestation, a demonstration, something like that. Well, so in 1997, in an air base, a U.S. air base called Aviano, which is halfway between Trieste and Venice, we're going to talk about Trieste in a minute, there was a demonstration against the Afghanistan, Kosovo war. And a group from Milan, the Yabasa Association, and Rome, and I believe Genoa, who were wearing the white overalls, decided to adopt the turtle shell tactic. And that is, they did a little thinking about, you know, the terms of political protest. They were sick and tired of their comrades coming away from a protest with broken noses and broken arms. And so they decided to pad themselves up. And they took it a bit further and developed an entire retinue of shields and padding and armor and all these kind of things. And they successfully shut down the entrance to this airbase for about 4 hours. And those images, the iris effect of that one protest reverberated around Italy, and almost within a year, there were Tutte Bianche turtle shell tactic groups developing in almost every city.
The turtle shell tactic was something that was borrowed from like the Roman times. It was this idea that like if you create these shields and you huddle together as a huge mass, a well-orchestrated mass, you can protect yourselves from bullets, rubber bullets, tear gas, blah, 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 you know, and you're able to move as a unit. So it's very strategic. You basically, you create this, like, you not only are you padded and armored yourself, but you as a collective group of people are able to move as this armored unit. And when they were able to get to the gates of the detention center, they were able to negotiate with the police and negotiate with the people running the center, and they were able to get people inside to like photograph and take pictures of what was going on in there. So it was very, it wasn't just it wasn't just playing off the media, it wasn't just for the shock value of it, it was actually very, very tactically effective. They got what they asked for.
And it's also, I think, about like the concept of having a smaller number of people be able to counter greater forces or greater numbers by that sort of pulling together and covering and things like that, and sort of that real tight formation piece.
And that center was shut down within the month.
Yeah, that the center you're talking about is called Via Corelli. It was in Milan, actually, and that was in...
It was shut down. Wait, no, it was a detention center.
Oh.
It was an immigrant detention center in Milan. It was basically a way station for immigrants that had been collected up by the state in northern Italy, and they would send them to Milan to the center called Via Corelli. And Via Corelli had notorious conditions, really bad stuff. I guess it made Gitmo look like Club Med. It was really, really bad. And so there was a demonstration in Milan, and that was in 99, I believe. Yeah, that was in 99. And they successfully shut down the center for a while, for about a day. But the action and the activities centered around it, with the Tutti Bianche and the media focus and everything, it went all over the place. It essentially raised the awareness of everybody in Italy of this place. And within a year, they shut that place down. So that's one good, really good example of how the tactic was used in order to for a concrete goal. And there's a couple others. During the Kosovo War in Trieste, and Trieste is on the border between Italy and at that time Yugoslavia. Was it broken up in 97? It was starting to break up. Trieste, there was also detention centers of refugees trying to leave the war, fighting. And the Tutti Bianche, the Abbas Association pulled off a successful demonstration there as well, utilizing these tactics. And this was all really pretty much within a year, 97, 98. And then in 98, kind of jumping ahead, a young Nigerian girl was killed in Belgium called Samira Adamu. And the European networks, European Counter Network, the Abbas Association, some other networks, People's Global Action that was just beginning to develop, called for a day of civil disobedience, a day of protest for immigrants' rights. And that was a big... That was when the Trieste Detention Center protest happened. That was the second Trieste Detention Center protest. So the point is, within a year of this the first Aviano action, this notion of the Tutti Bianche it caught on like wildfire, and everybody wanted to try it. All these people started to gravitate toward it. A lot of groups started to adopt the tactic, including some institutional left groups. And then finally, in 1998, to sort of get done with the prequel, in 1998, the social centers got together in Milan at Leoncavallo, and they got together and decided to make an agreement to follow the terms of what they had been doing for the last couple of years. They came to an agreement about utilizing the Tutubianque as a tactic, and they tried to agree to certain avenues of approach. They wouldn't throw Molotovs. They wouldn't. They had a lot of discussion about the level of violence versus nonviolence and what it means. And they decided to empower some spokespeople. This is when Luca Casarini started to rise through the ranks, so to speak, of spokespeople. And so they called it the Charter of Milan. And the Charter of Milan was, for the Italian movements, was a sort of a historical situation. Because a lot of institutional left groups and a lot of anarchist groups and a lot of different groups all from the left spectrum decided to sort of join on to this. There were rifts, but it was very successful in that sense. And what we get out of the Charter of Milan, essentially, was Prague. And Prague was the IMF World Bank meeting in Prague in September 2000. And that was the really the beginning of the worldwide Eros effect. And I'm sure a lot of people here were probably saw those pictures from Prague of the white overalls group on the Nevsky Bridge, you know, on the other side of the convention center, showing down the cops. And that action and those actions in Prague were made possible because of the agreements that happened in Italy and also agreements within the coalition that was forming around the anti-IMF World Bank meetings. Okay, so that's now we're segueing out of Italy, and we can jump back when we talk about concepts and philosophy into Italy and all that kind of stuff. But now we're going to talk about the Eros effect. Now I've been using that term a lot, and it's not my term. It's obviously been thrown around by different people, particularly this writer George Katsiafikas, who's an autonomous Marxist writer. He wrote a really good book on. Called The Subversion of Politics, on the German Autonomen Movement. You should all get it. It's really good. But he wrote a book a few years ago called The Eros Effect about 1968. And why 1968? For some reason, 1968, all around the world, in the United States, in Europe, in Japan, in Africa, in China, in Latin America, Mexico, Argentina, Chile, 1968, for some reason, that year, all of these different left movements were just thriving. And left activity and resistance was at a peak. And within 5 years, in most places, except for places like Italy, it would be back down. So he talked about the Eros. He said, there's an Eros effect. That is, for the first time in the history of the world, because of the media becoming global, that ideas and notions of revolution and activity travels fast. And so you would see within a month of a protest like Kent State, you would see a notion being adopted halfway around the world, but changed in form, and it's hard to tell the inspiration, but you can just kind of like, it looks like it, it feels like it, but it's not called it. So this is the Eros effect, and this is notions of social movements adopting from other social movements. And so the Eros effect is a really good way to term how the white overall sort of infected the left around the world in September, October, and November, particularly of 2000. Because you had a group in New York, you had a group in Cancun, you had a group in São Paulo, you had a group in London, you had a group in France, Spain, Finland, Austria, Cincinnati, New York, within 3 or 4 months, deciding to adopt this tactic and organize around it. And that was particularly because of the images and the ideas. And, you know, hardly any of these, with exception of Europe probably, hardly any of these people that were identifying with this and adopting this tactic participated in it. We in New York didn't participate in it. In Prague, or in anything previous to Prague. And so that's the Eros effect. And okay, so within a few months, Prague and the international growth of the movement started to fuel different discussions and all that kind of stuff. And to jump ahead, history. History part is really long. Yeah. So,
interesting.
Is that right? Okay. So, to jump ahead to, let's jump ahead to Genoa. Between Prague. Oh yeah, y'all want to come in and try to like filter in, get more chairs.
There's additional chairs out in the hall.
You can sit on the floor too.
Get more chairs.
Okay, so between Prague and Genoa. Between Prague and Genoa, there were all sorts of little efforts here and there. In Europe, there was Naples. There was a protest in Naples. A couple protests here and there. Austria, in New York, the New York City Yavasta Collective that developed out of the Eros Effect. We did a few protests. We tried to get to Quebec City. Didn't work out. It's a long story for another conversation. In Cincinnati. They formed a group in Brazil, in Mexico, in Canada, in Houston. So all these different groups started popping up, and nothing really coalesced into anything large until Genoa. And in Genoa, which was in July of 2001, there was a G8 meeting, and I'm sure a lot of us have heard about this. It was a huge demonstration. There was something like 500,000 people on the Friday and Saturday that came through the city. The level of repression was immense. And the white overalls decided to get rid of the white overalls. And their action was, there was about 10,000 people in that padded block. They called it the padded block at that point, or disobedienti. There's a lot of names they're throwing around. But the level of repression was such that there was really no successes in that regard. The successes came later, and we can talk about that as well conceptually. So Genoa was the swan song of the Tutti Bianchi movement, and there's been a lot of recrimination, a lot of criticism after the fact, a lot of discussions about what it was, and the three pieces that are in this pamphlet that I've been handing around sort of talk about that. If y'all want these, any questions? Questions?
Was there intention of nonviolence, is there, like, you've asked to, like, if you're engaging in the Yavasta tactic, or in particular, white overall tactic, would you, was there ever any instances where you could also, like, work with the Black Bloc without that condition? Or I've heard some different stories about, like, some conflicts between maybe more, between those, I guess, those two efforts in certain.
We can talk about that during the criticism portion. There's a place for that. So we'll segue into the concepts so we can start talking about the concepts and then we'll to the
why do you get rid of the white overalls? Particularly, why did you get rid of those white overalls?
Okay. Well, they were having discussions in Genoa in the Carlini Stadium, which was like the proving ground for what they were doing for the actions. And through various spokespeople and through various meetings, they decided that the white overalls was becoming too much of an identity, and they wanted to subsume their struggles within the larger multitude, the struggles of the multitude, meaning they wanted to be like everybody else. Well, it's hard to be like everybody else when you're padded, you know, the nines. So that was one of the reasons. Some say it was premature, but we're going to get into that a bit in the criticisms as well. But, so I'm just going to throw some pictures for some concepts. So hopefully you can all see these. Okay, so this is from France that happened, I think, about a year ago. And this was the so-called riots that were happening in I forgot the name of the neighborhood. One of the suburbs, yeah. The northwestern suburbs, Clichy, I think. You can see the media look like the Tutti Bianchi. This is well after the fact. It's awesome. This is just another notion of media. Uniformity. Notions of uniformity. That's a Palestinian. It's in Beit HaMor. Okay. So that's this guy from Germany. Interesting picture. One of the classic armor types that they would partake in is the soda empty soda bottles, and they would take them off. Okay. So let's talk about concepts. Let me get to my. So we've talked about that the Zapatista inspiration and the mythopoesis of Marcos Del Zero. Maybe you guys want to talk about some of that Zapatista inspiration.
Well, I mean, I think that there, going back to the piece that you were talking about around concepts of violence versus nonviolence and things like that, I think that part of that piece is very intentionally creating or challenging some of the concepts around dualities of that, around dualities of any type, so that there is sort of absolute violence and absolute nonviolence and, absolute good and absolute evil and all those kinds of things. And I think that very much is also sort of from that tradition of really sort of challenging what do those things mean and what are ways in which folks can engage in nonviolence that doesn't sort of look like what we think nonviolence looks like in terms of the history, particularly in the U.S., of what that looks like and things like that.
Yeah, a couple of the ideas that that Sick of the Leeds group talks about in this essay, and you should all read this essay, is notions that were sort of inchoate within the Avesta ideas. First notion is changing the world without taking power. It's become sort of a cliche lately. But it really had its roots there. Within the Zapatistas and then translated in Italy, translated through the Tutti Bianchi. These are right out of the communiques. March with questions on our lips, not with blueprints for revolutions. Reject the old binaries that trapped our thinking for so long. Violence versus nonviolence, reform versus revolution. That's an interesting one, too. Seek a world made of difference, a world containing many worlds, a world without borders. One no, many yeses. So we're all against capitalism, but we're not really we're not all for the same things. So at least we can have a dialogue about what we're for and agree that we're against capitalism. Our struggles are united by our shared opposition to capitalism. Those ideas the Italians attempted to translate through a movement on the street. Very difficult to do. Anybody does theory in action? Very difficult to take your ideas and translate them directly into a street protest. The Tutti Bianchi got closest that I've ever seen of any movement since the 60s, since the civil rights movement, to directly translating notions of political subjectivity, that is the body and the person and the subject, rather than the object being worked on, but the subject being worked through, right? First time since the civil rights movement, and in the West, and so that's some ideas.
I mean, I think the other concept that is very much sort of, my understanding taken sort of out of that inspiration from the Zapatista movement is the idea, and I think this can also go into some of the criticisms piece in the U.S., is talking about gender and
who is part of movement and what roles particularly women and female bodied people take on within things like Ibasta and things like that. And, you know, there was some explicit focus on several, if you look at sort of different calls to action that folks have put out over a long period of time, particularly earlier in that time that you're talking about, there's some acknowledgement around, you know, women definitely being part of that and sort of pushing that societal concept around what place women have in quote-unquote violence versus nonviolence, and what place women have in having their bodies be part of their political action, right? And it includes things around LGBT folks and other sort of marginalized folks, and what the different sort of, you know, ethos that we have around bodies and using your body as a tool around social change and social justice as it applies particularly to marginalized communities.
Yeah, you know, the problem with the social movements in general that are so efficacious, like the Tutibianke, that are so like huge, and they involve so many different things, so many different groups, is that it's hard to really clarify it into any concepts. So like when I was thinking about what are the basic concepts, it's like there's so many concepts that aren't basic concepts, that it involves so many different things, that, you know, this notion of like Foucault and biopower. Anybody read Foucault? I mean, this notion of biopower, the power of the body as opposed to the power of the collectivity, or as opposed to the power of the individual, as opposed to the power of power. I mean, there's all these different ideas, right? Well, there's little parts of that filtered into it, and little parts of like of Negri's research into the changing conditions of labor in Italy. Negri and a lot of the other, you know, Massimo
Verno,
that's right. Yeah, Agamben, bare life versus naked life. These are like theoretical concepts that the Italians have been talking about for the last 20 years. And they filter into it. And then the Zapatistas come along, and you add a little bit of this into that as well. And you have all these different groups. You have a group in, let's say, Padua, that's talking about Verno. And you have a group in Milan that's talking about the Zapatistas, and they're trying to solidify it, and these conversations going on, you know. That's a real testing ground for ideas. And what you get in the end is this mush, right? This mush of theory and praxis put together, praxis. You know, they like to say that the Tutibianke was a new way of doing politics. Some say it wasn't really politics, because politics are the roots that we sink into actual everyday world, communities, workplaces. That's politics, right? And then finding ways for people to make decisions about how their communities and their workplaces affect them. Well, the Tutibianke really wasn't about that. But it kind of was about that. So there's a little... Okay. So... Any questions before we move on to... I'm going to show a video, and then you guys can talk about practice.
Well, I think it's important to sort of stress that concept of, like, a new reframing of theory and practice. I think a lot of time in sort of radical culture and different social movements we talk about... That, again, talk about that as duality, so that people are either really into practice or they're really into theory. And clearly, people are somewhere along in that spectrum. Some of us are very into theory, some of us are very into practice, and it goes along. But I think the ideas that are created and the things that come together in that sort of mash of concepts are accessible. There are things that you don't have to know, you know, which writer this came from and things like that. They're ideas and concepts that fuel an action in a way that I think is very different than perhaps folks have looked at before, and is something that is accessible to folks, and is not just about sort of being in your head and things like that.
And it's also a political project. Have I mentioned that? It's a political project. They like to... They used to like to say, and I repeat it often, Tutibianke is a political project. And it is a political project. It's notions, like we said, notions, different ideas of the body and political protest all melted into this mishmash, this salad of ideas.
Right.
And then take those ideas and push them forward and see what happens. You know, that's a political project. I'm really... I really love this scene. It's from Gandhi, the film Gandhi. Everybody should have a copy of the DVD of that. This is the Darasana Salt Works. It's a famous scene. And
what's happening here?
Okay, this is Gandhi is in jail at this point, I believe. He's in prison. And some of his these are people that are trying to shut down the salt works.
He's not in jail at this point.
No?
They've been locked out. I think he may have been preemptively arrested before this.
I think so, yeah.
And then these are people who are locked out of a salt factory by their employers and British colonial police.
Was he in jail?
What?
Yeah.
I think he's in jail during this scene. He's not in jail for very long. He's just picked off. They're like, we got the leadership.
Right.
Okay. So the women are preparing the medical supplies. The men are lining up in rows of
five or seven
in front of the salt works. And it's a great scene. And they are undeterred by fear. And they know what they're gonna get. They know they're expecting violence. They're expecting pain. Suffering, but they're undeterred. They are prostrating themselves, essentially, but a different kind of form of prostration. So that's Nehru. Mm-hmm. It's Nehru giving a speech. We will be absolutely nonviolent. Something, something. And this is like some U.S. media. Oh, and they're approaching the forces of order. So who's not familiar with this scene? Okay. There's no sound, though. That goes on, and that scene and other scenes like it during that time changed worldwide public opinion on the movement in India, and eventually forced Crown to negotiate for independence.
People see what's happening? That they're methodically they're in these lines, these straight lines, and they're methodically marching forward one line. They get beat down. The women come, they take them away, they tend to their wounds, the next line proceeds forward, and they move in these waves up against the forces, and they just are ultimate, they're completely nonviolent. They do nothing to protect themselves or to hurt the others, and it keeps going and going and going. The line is so long.
So we know who has the authority of power, but who's got the moral authority? That's what's all about. Okay.
You think that's why the Molotov cocktails, like when we bring that into demonstrations, that's what ends up, it takes away some of that moral authority look that one tries to do, just asking.
Okay, we can get into that part, I guess. I mean, that's part of the criticism discussion, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, also, you know, the 60s drew on a similar thing where, like, you know, when you show police brutality against, you know, unarmed folks in the street, you know, the media is going to pick up on that, and you know, that's terrifying to see. The same thing here, like,
you know, Martin Sheen's like on the phone, you know, calling everybody saying they went on, they were unarmed, they were nonviolent, you know, automatically your sympathies go out. How can these people who are supposed to be protecting you beat down on these unarmed civilians? Like, you know, you wind up having the sympathetic advantage, even if not the moral high ground in addition to that, just because who's the general readership going to sympathize with in that scenario? I mean, that's terrible.
I think it is. I think the only thing that strikes me is I can't help but feel like it's... I just wonder if you know, I mean, maybe there's something moral authority, but it seems like it's sort of robbing the movement of a legitimate right to promote politics, which advance, you know, the idea of the necessity for conflict and the absolute necessity for the eventuality of conflict. I think that's my problem. Like, I understand nonviolence is a tactical concern, but it feels like absolute nonviolence is like giving the state such a huge weapon. And that's what bothers me about it.
Well, and I think, again, like as we sort of move into talking about like recent incarnations of this, and particularly the group here and the participation that we did on March 19th and things like that, I think the challenge is to again start to think about what do we think not absolute nonviolence means, right? We have this picture in our head of like people sitting in the streets and things like that. And I think that sort of some of the mythos, some of the use of Yavasta is to revision conflict, to revision that in a different way, right? Because some folks would say that walking through police lines with shields and things like that, all padded up, is not nonviolent, right? Yeah. Other folks would say, yes, it is. And so I think that there's a real sort of challenge to revision our traditional concepts of those dualities and what those things look like. And I think that sort of Yavasta is a great way in which to catch people's imagination around, we're tired of the same old thing, we're tired of sort of looking at these things in absolutist terms of this is exactly what it means to be nonviolent, this is exactly what it means to engage in violence and things like that. So
it's really good to talk about. I see a lot of the reason I'm interested in came to talk about Yavasta is like I also see definitely the sort of the downside of organizing like black bloc work, where I feel like I'm not sure if it, I think I feel like that doesn't have the same ability to draw support. I feel like that's alienating. So I think, you know, talking about that in the absolute sense is really important.
The interesting thing about when we talk about the black bloc in this country, for instance, as a particular tactic of street protests during demonstrations, there's not a lot of difference between black bloc tactics and the Tutti Bianchi tactics that were going on in Europe. That is, I've been in a couple black blocs, and the ones that I've been in, I didn't see Molotovs, I didn't see rocks or sticks thrown. I saw a tight cohesion, a self-disciplined tight cohesion. I've seen you know, cool, calm-headed people who know what they're doing and care about what they're doing. They care about the effects that they have on their surroundings and on the protests and on public opinion, et cetera, et cetera. I think that when we're talking about the Tutti Bianchi, and David Graeber mentions this in his article in the pamphlet, a very important point that classically street protests, that's why I showed the picture of the weathermen, classically street protests, you have two sides of that coin. You have the high level of confrontation, what we call violence, and then you have the low level of confrontation, we call nonviolence. But in fact, it's actually a spectrum. And it's a spectrum that has really little to do with us. It has everything to do with the state. And that's what the Tutti Bianchi were trying to underline, is that we are in this game with the state. Okay, it's actually, there's three elements. Okay, there's the media, there are the police, and then there's civil society. And they're all kind of interlinked, right? Now, civil society are the ordinary people's functionaries, right? The media would know the media, and the state in the form of the police. And so the Tutti Bianchi is saying, okay, well, what do we have to do politically as a project? What do we have to do to raise the level of the dialogue about this relationship without falling into the same binaries of violence versus nonviolence, reform versus revolution? So they developed this project utilizing the media, utilizing the poetry, you know, sending out press releases. And when the right-wing media, before Genoa was saying, oh, the Tutti Bianchi are going to come mess up Genoa, they sent out a press release saying, we declare war on the Tutti. Generalist, set it aside for a moment, actually. Prague is a better idea, because when they came to Prague, it was huge groups of people with those water guns. They had balloons. They had, like, these accoutrements that were just absolutely outrageous. You know, some of the photographs, if you go to one of the websites, you'll see it's kind of an absurdity for European, compare it to the Ottoman. You know, these black clad with the black helmets in this tight formation, you know. It's a different level of struggle. And we have to ask the question, what is the level of struggle out there today? You know, is it China in the 1920s or 30s? Of course not. Is it Spain in the 1920s or 30s? No. I mean, we live in a highly media saturated, spectacularized culture. So what do we need to do to build movements and eventually to build the grassroots movements that we're going to need to have the real discussions about, for instance, you know, armed confrontation? Because we know that historically, if you read about all the different revolutions and you agree with this scenario, this perspective, then there's going to come a time when armed confrontation is going to happen. So the question is what relations we can take. But now it's debatable. But now, I mean, come on. Is now that time? No. So what is the level of confrontation? And that's what the Tutubianke answered. Well, the level, this could be the level of confrontation. That was a long one.
They also shift the power, you know, by, I mean, this is sort of a time-worn thing, but when you prostrate yourself, you are saying that this arrest, this beating, this whatever is going to happen on my terms because I'm allowing it to happen, and I'm allowing everybody to see, to witness this, to bear witness to this atrocity. So you simultaneously undermine these people's, the state's power, because you're saying, I'm going to let you do this to me. I'm not going to fight this in the way that you expect me to fight it. So I think that Tutubianke, you know, manipulates that notion as well, with the padding and with, you know, in some cases prostration, in some cases not, and announcing what the intended goal is, to make it a very public act, to say this will be demonstrable, you can all watch this happen, we're not here to hide anything, we're not doing anything wrong. And I think that, I mean, we haven't talked about the poetry of it at all, but I think that would be like a logical next step. I feel like that informs all of the directions. Yeah.
A lot of really interesting imagery in the slideshow and everything comes to mind. I think like one important concept in this can be the concept of narrative power and the stories that, you know, changing how a protest, what meanings it communicates, and how, like, the Gandhi film, I think, is one of the most, I don't look at that and have questions of violence, nonviolence so much as how did they change the meaning about their struggle, make it visible, have sympathetic characters that people around the world could identify with. And I think that's a major thing we have to look at, no matter what context we're organizing in, is, are we sympathetic characters to the broader population? Is the way that we're presenting ourselves going to draw, you know, going to get people, make people sympathetic to the cause? Or basically, I think we need an analysis of how society, particularly in the United States, is really inoculated against radical change and radical change agents. And we have to navigate, I think, and create these kinds of scenarios where that actually changed the story about who we are, about that, and that's, I'll wrap up here, but the one thing that comes to mind and the question I have about Yabasta and the white overalls and the turtle padding and everything, I'm not there, it's not my context. Like here, I have questions about whether that would generate sympathy, just because people are so ready to dismiss anything that looks a little bit different in this society. And it depends where you are in this. I mean, New York's different than a lot of places, but in a national context. What do we import from other places? How do we, all that stuff about the concepts that we're trying to embody, I think is so important, you know, about kind of prefiguring the world we want to look like, but how do we come up with ways of testing whether it's working and not just be content to be like, there's this autonomous project and there's this and it's really good. How do we test how far we're engaging the populace, how far we're going? Bunch of questions.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, to me it's like through the padding and everything here in the U.S. would seem like through humor, but I don't know in the broader context if that's the point. I did think in terms of like Gandhi and sympathy, and yeah, because to me it would be like through humor, and it's almost like funny, and that's great, but I guess if you're trying to get sympathy, I'm not, you know, I wouldn't know that the outfit would do that, because a lot of people, as they're walking by, don't pause long enough to really know or question. That's just would be my wonderment. But New York loves humor, so.
Or the media for the rest of the country, like, you know, why not go to protests just in just working class clothes or shirts and ties?
And I think, you know, there's also security concerns, and you want to make sure you're probably the least developed clothes, or you can at least cover your face and stuff, and you want to just go and tie into the suit.
Well, I mean, like, a shirt and tie with a gas mask on, I think that should be acceptable. I don't know.
Well, the thing
you have to, you do, you have to protect, you don't want to sit in the tear gas, but...
Yeah, let's get back to the, these are great ideas, concepts and notions, but let's get back to the basically, we're going to get to the critique real quick, because we're running through the time, but just really quick, a couple ideas, like a couple concepts of the practice. Like what was going on? It's been mentioned negotiation without collaboration. Carter mentioned it. Angie might mention it about developing a particular project for a particular action. You have your spokespeople, and your spokespeople say, "Now we are going to do this." As you're saying, you know, we're going to go from A to B. We're going to shut down that thing. You know, we're going to do this action, and. The police need to stay out of our way, and then you know, you go a block, and then you stop, and you say, you know, now the police won't let us go, so we're going to do something else. So the notion is this orchestrated confrontation, and negotiating with the police, but without collaboration. So you're saying, we're going to do this. You don't want to let us do that? Fine, we're going to do that. You don't want to do this? Okay, well, fine, we'll do this. But not, what do you want us to do? You see the difference? Okay. So all of this implies a couple things. It implies a level of media awareness that we rarely have here. Like the left, when we do protests, if we get 500,000 people in the streets of New York, we might get on the front page of the Metro, Metro News, whatever the daily is. The Times will put us on page 6. In Italy, even though Berlusconi, during Genoa, for instance, owned like half the media, they still got a lot of positive coverage of the retribution of you know, all the violence and all that kind of stuff. So the media climate is completely different. So when you're talking about these projects, you know, we're talking about being able to pull off a project like this, you're talking about pulling it off through movements that are very strong, including media movements. You know, there were maybe 4 or 5 independent radio stations in Italy at the time. Radio Sherwood was one of them, that reached millions of people, run by the left. You're talking about grassroots movements and movements that have been around, again, the social centers, for instance, that have a base. You know, when we don't like to talk about base because nobody's got any. Which is why everybody should go to the social forum, by the way. Because those are actually organizations, base is going to that thing in June in Atlanta, okay? But when we talk about a base, we're talking about people that know your existence and they know what you do, and you know, you
take the temperament every now and then. There's some sort of connection to it, you know. 100 years ago, the notion of the base was much solid than it is today. And, of course, we knew the Maoists and have much better ideas when we're talking about the base. Whether they follow through with them or not is a different story. We talk about prostration. We mentioned prostration a couple times. But it's a prostration in what... The notion of prostration is, you know, you're getting down like this on your knee and saying, ah, you know, my king, my lord, and, you know, with the sword and all that shit. This is more like, okay, I understand that you're the state. I understand that you're the police, and you can kill me right now. And a lot of the Tutti Bianchi in Genoa didn't understand the level of repression that they would get. But still, while you're doing this and you're saying, excuse my friends, fuck you, asshole. Yeah, that's right. I know, you know, I hate you, you know. So during their actions, they would stand up and they would say, we are not violent. And they would say, here we come, you bastards, here we come. You know, with your arms in prone position, right? So it's that dichotomy, you know. Violence versus nonviolence. You know, prostrate versus demonstrate. So, okay, anything else to add to that? Okay, let's jump into critique, because people love to talk critique. Because we're on short time.
Yeah.
So, let's I'm going to say something, and maybe you can talk about the machismo and bravado, and, So, I'm going to talk about political project versus complementary tactics. So, there were, during the Tutti Bianchi's development, there were really two solid... notions of what it should have been, and we've covered that up briefly. There's the political project, that is the Tutti Bianchi is I'm in the Tutti Bianchi, I'm part of the Tutti Bianchi, you know, I'm the spokesperson of the Tutti Bianchi. Instead of I'm the spokesperson for NIMA's anti-war working group, and we've utilized the Tutti Bianchi tactics. You see the difference? So a complementary tactic or a tactic that a group and many groups adopt and utilize as tools to raise an awareness, for instance, right? And the Black Bloc is a good example of that as well. That is, I mean, nobody's in the Black Bloc, and there's been a lot of back and forth about that for the last 10 years in the United States. You know, the media says there's a Black Bloc, but we know there's no Black Bloc. The Tutti Bianchi, there actually was a Tutti Bianchi, but there were people that thought in Italy, thought there shouldn't be a Tutti Bianchi. And thus, we get Genoa taking off the white overalls. If you go to the websites that are listed in the pamphlet, the Wuming Collective, they were involved in the developments, and they have some things to say about this on their website. So you should read that.
Yeah, and I think one of the challenges and one of, you know, the critiques that come with sort of broadening this discussion to talk about issues of violence versus nonviolence, really pushing that envelope a little bit, comes in the sort of way in which all of the isms, all of that stuff plays out within our organizing and our political projects as well, right? And so, you know, while your experience with a Black Bloc may be different than mine, my experience as a female body person with Black Bloc or with other sort of clearly pushing the envelope of what violence is groups has been a lot of sexism, a lot of machismo, a lot of privilege, right? So it has been folks who traditionally, my experience, again, young white males who have a lot of aggression to get out, really utilizing a political tactic in order to do that and not necessarily framing that and what that means within the larger context of what you're doing, right? So that has been a lot of my experience. And I think that that's true around sort of Yabasta, and my understanding is that's true around some of the more recent incarnations in this country, is this notion of particularly, because I don't think necessarily as, you know, an anarchist movement or whatever, we've necessarily come hugely far in recognizing gender identity as a spectrum and things like that, so we're often creating the male-female dichotomy, right? And so what is the place of female-bodied people within sort of pushing violence and the potential for experiencing violence, and what work do sort of male-bodied folks have to do around the concept of, okay, I'm not going to react differently if Carter starts getting hit than I am if Moose is, right? So I'm not going to escalate my level of tactic based on the gender of the person that something is happening to. And so how does that sort of also talk about the internal work that we do as collectives, as groups, and things like that? And I think that also really plays out in the concept of going out with the intent of pushing an envelope and getting yourself arrested, and the sort of acknowledgement of what privilege exists around that, right? There are people in our communities who, for just being who they are walking down the street, get arrested every day. What does it mean for us to utilize the privilege that we have to seek arrest or to seek a confrontation with law enforcement when there are folks who exist in our communities that's not a choice, you know? For trans folks, for folks of color, for low-income folks, that's not necessarily a choice that they're making. And so what is the political implication of folks making that choice? And so there's a lot, I think, that is important to think about this in terms of it being a political project that is both external and internal, right? So it's movement building and it's external, and it's around organizing and pulling other folks in.
I definitely experienced, there's definitely, huge issues around patriarchy and gender. But I feel like you said, the Black Bloc is an organization, it's a tactic. I think certain sections, especially particularly working class, centered anarcho-communist sections of the Black Bloc, I felt like I've been better on that, but still something to work on. I think the base issue is that as long as we remain, if it's going to be a political project, I think we're always going to run into that of only having, privilege. That it seems like there has to be, like, for example, if a riot could be a spontaneous act of insurrection, and the people will utilize, maybe some of these tactics we're talking about, like working class people, immigrants. So I think what's important is working on tactics. Like, in that DC on the 27th, there's a lot of folks who feel like I'm having, like, shields or tactics. And I think if you can focus more on just pushing those than having a specific political context, I've lost what I was trying to say. Basically, I think what we need to do is be able to build movements where more communities will be willing to go with shields, and so whatever can bring that, I guess.
And I guess there's also this concept that is really important to me too, around sort of political projects and creating space, because really, I think when you start talking about issues around privilege and things like that, I think that a lot of times we get trapped into this place of saying, we're going to bring disenfranchised community into the tactics we have chosen. We're going to educate and tell, marginalized communities so that they can come into the tactics that we create. When really, for me, it's about thinking about how can I utilize the privilege that I have or the experience that I have to create space for those folks to create their own stuff, to create their own realities, to create their own sort of what their action looks like and things like that, as opposed to sort of what often to me feels a little bit paternalistic in terms of, the ways we talk about communities and things like that. So I think, there's a lot of different concepts. None of these are perfect things, but I think there's a lot that sort of goes into how we think about who we bring into movements and in what way.
One thing I wanted to mention as far as these dynamics is that particular movements tend to have, or particular tactical efforts tend to generate their own media image, which then kind of gravitates people around that image. And I think that, Black Blocs have been fairly aggressive and masculine in their media image, despite some of their demographics in terms of who's actually sort of behind the hoodies. Consciously working on that is one thing. I don't know if I missed some of this in the earlier portion, but a lot of times this either white or orange overalls has been in the same spaces, same collective action spaces and at the city level as both Black Blocs and this thing called Pink and Silver Blocs, which have been one self-consciously using a different way of engaging with the police called tactical frivolity. The idea of it's similar to prostration in a sense, and it uses some of this idea of using sort of fun forms of aggression that then become unquestionably nonviolent but set up the same kind of problem, or by being so flamboyant and boisterous in your occupation of space, that you just refuse to be moved around, but it's very different to be pushed around as someone who looks like you're there for a confrontation versus someone who looks like you're there for a party. It just, that changes some of those dynamics. I've seen in San Francisco a non-organization called Anti-War Action called a series of different block convergences during the anti-war period, and one of which was just anyone who wanted to break away, one of which was particularly called as a black block and ended up being black plus pink in the sense of a group called Gay Shame brought out a lot of folks there. And so you had people who were willing to sort of aggressively confront the police. Primarily, actually, in both these cases, they weren't more willing to aggressively confront property than the police, and the numbers primarily acted to keep people away from the line of police that was kind of continuously advancing on them, and enabled a lot of redecoration of property and a number of other sort of, kind of interesting visual occurrences to happen. So the one thing that I think is also relevant to this discussion of who is... like, who does the tactic appeal to and what kind of power dynamics go on in it, is whether or not a block aims specifically to get arrested, to not get arrested, to find ways of getting away. And so to me, like, a number of the things around frustration I want to have some distance on, because I'm really into people getting away. And by getting away, I don't just mean, like, escaping the police, but I mean getting away with what they plan to do. In really active ways. And I think that strategizing around that and around, you know, maintaining lines of people so that the cops are a certain distance out, maintaining, like, there's a lot that tactical innovation can bring to something like this. And there's a lot that particular blocks can bring to a scene in which not everyone is in their block. So there's a lot that, like, a meaningful, you know, shields and padding group can do in the event when police are advancing on a much larger crowd. And strategizing about that and not always assuming that, like, the way to deploy privilege is to get taken down, but sometimes the way to deploy privilege is to take certain risks while other people are taking other risks and, like, collaborate. Mm-hmm.
I respond. I'll be quick. Piggybacking on what Carol said, that the white overalls, and I'm curious as to how they do this, because I've been part of black blocs in the U.S. where the ideal of, you know, it's not a group, it's people coming and being part of this tactic. How, given actions like that, mass actions like that, how do you have self-reflection and change course, you know, as a movement, and say, this isn't working, or this worked well, or this is generating this kind of image, and it's not strategic, or this might be more strategic. How do we do that effectively and quickly when you don't have any kind of group cohesion that can have an actual praxis to have a theory, go into an action, reflect on it, and make the necessary alterations to be effective? So that's a big question for me. And then with that, I think when we don't have that, we run the risk of this ritual that just happens. Like, oh, there's a protest happening, there's this confrontation, and there's these rituals that become ingrained in our subculture. And they kind of become a rite of passage, and we start to equate militancy with radical or militancy with effective, whereas maybe militancy is effective in this certain context at this certain time, and maybe another time it's totally not effective at all, right? And I think we run the risk without figuring out how to have groups that are self-reflective, that are working in a praxis of this artificial hierarchy of tactics where, you know, going to a protest is good, taking the streets is better, and fucking shit up is, like, you know, the end-all be-all, right? Where, you know, what kind of instrumental objectives are these things accomplishing? What kind of image are they showing? That's it.
So, go ahead.
I was just going to respond to that, but I think it's interesting that sometimes the groups that are the most cohesive, or not necessarily cohesive, but identify as a group, are also the same groups that keep on, like, you know, like literally like walking into walls over and over again. They confront the same issue, the same thing keeps happening. We keep having a freaking march. We keep doing this thing. We keep doing that thing. And so it's interesting because I feel like sometimes the decentralized actions tend to be more creative and adaptive than the organized groups who keep on saying we have to keep trying this over and over again, like without adopting a new strategy. I think that might come into play because you attract a certain kind of person, that, you know, a certain group of people. Those people are only willing to risk so much, so you have to be able to either draw from a large spectrum of people or draw from a crowd that is willing to escalate but might start off in a certain way and then figure out either divergent or riskier tactics to be more effective next time.
So you both got me thinking, because we have to end it, we're done. Well, our time is over, but that sucks. But I was going to try to wrap it up with maybe lessons and talk about lessons. And I think you summed up some really good lessons, Matthew, and I think you added to that, definitely. And some lessons are basically, you know, I think the lessons from the Tutu Bianche isn't that, okay, how do we replicate this particularly, but how do we, like, how do we build political projects that are both fed by the movements that they're part of and feed into movements, utilizing notions across borders. So the Zapatista to Italy to here, it's very interesting, right? Of course, you know, before Chiapas, there are other movements. So from those movements, so you see the line, the trajectories. How do we reinvigorate our movements, like Angie mentioned, reinvigorate them without becoming stale, but also, and I completely agree with Matthew, to be able to form organizational initiatives that enable us to clarify what we're doing, and organizationally to be able to self-reflect along the way, not just, you know, 5-6 years after the fact, but along the way. So these are all like lessons that
incorporate those structures you were talking about, particularly like we were talking about the other night. Like, how do you, as an organization, incorporate a way to resist systems of racism, systems of sexism? You know, how do you? There is a way to build that into a structure so that you're simultaneously having to do like inside personal work, but also you're in a system that facilitates, you know, equal treatment for all participants.
And I think also, like, how do we, and this is where I get really cheesy, but, you know, because I'm all about the whole love and revolution concept, and it's like, how do we sort of create political projects or tactics that really build on that sort of mytho, you know, we always talk about the mythopoetic concept, right, which is really about, I can't believe we've only said that, like, once during this entire workshop. Mythopoiesis, right? So what is that? It's like, I think that's the acknowledgement that, like, as we are doing these sort of engaging in conflict, engaging in hard work, engaging with a state that is inherently oppressive, we are also, like, humans, right? And so we need these things that capture our hearts. We need these things that are, you know, also celebrations of our life and that are about creating our own stories and our own history and reflecting those things, you know? We need art and music and humanity. I mean, I think one of the most sort of lessons for me was around this particular incarnation of doing Yabasta is the concept of, it's really about embodying your whole self and trying to bring that self and those needs and the internal sort of peace that we often don't get to do in organizing, right? Because we sort of, I think, create a dichotomy between being sort of a collective group and having it not be about individuals, and then also giving up this concept then that we're creating a history and we're creating a mythology and we're creating all those sort of things that are also inherently important and beautiful and nurture people's souls.
So lessons. So you're going to get more lessons by reading those articles and going to the websites. Orange Overalls has a new website as well. Yabasta, you can pick that up.
Is that completely part of the anti-war work group? Is that where this Yabasta effort will be continuing? Or is that?
Yeah, I should mention that as well. So this Yabasa thing was actually NYMA's anti-war working group.
Right.
And we decided to
debut. as it were.
Yeah.
On March 19th.
Oh, you wore the orange with them?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that meant?
That meant the orange hue. That meant a reimagining, a reinterpretation, and a ownership of our, you know, reincarnation. How many rings? of Yabasta.
And it's also equated with sort of the threat level piece around, homeland security and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But I would also say that in answer to that question, it's also, while that's where it's come out of, I think many of us have talked about it not being wedded to one particular sort of struggle or one particular issue.
That's why I'm figuring out where to go to keep.
Yeah.
That's where the meetings were presented.
Right. So it's not just connected to sort of anti-war. But yes, that's where.
And we could pass around a sheet for people interested in working with the current reincarnation of Yabasta.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody has a particular liking of the color orange.
Yeah, and I think if you go to the orange overall, there's a contact in, right? To get on the listserv and stuff, right, Moose?
There's information on the website.
And the rubber duckies?
Dollar store.
They're deeply symbolic, but we can't reveal who they are.
We can dress up as rubber duckies.
We had a lot of rubber duckies attached to us. And when we were arrested, the police were really concerned and asking, like, what was the symbolism of the rubber duckies? And I was like, I can't tell you.
You don't know.
Oh yeah, there it is. Frustrated. Wearing on my.
Do you have rubber duckies on you?
Somewhere.
Yeah, mine's
on my helmet.
It's really funny.
And we're all doing it again.
Yeah.
When?
We're gonna be infiltrating.
Today. Come to the meeting.
We're gonna have training soon.
Yeah, we're gonna do some training.
Go to orangeoveralls.net. And you can get in touch with us. Oh yeah, actually the one on the right, don't follow that. I messed up. It's wrong.
You didn't you just say the one on the right is wrong?
No, that is.
Okay.
Yeah. On the website, you'll see the video and some images, and then there's historical background, theoretical documents,
contact stuff.
And then the other link, NYC Yabasta, that's the old NYC site, and that has a lot more pictures, actually. It's got sort of a chronological order of all the different actions. It's not concise, but it's pretty good.
Well, there's a MySpace page.
MySpace.
So you can make Yabasta your friend. But I think it's almost considered also.
It's listed
it's on
Orange site. Overalls as well. Yeah. And finally, for those interested, New York Metro Alliance of Anarchists is having a general assembly next Saturday. You should come to that. General assemblies are always a good time. We don't wear orange overalls, but it's all right.
We could.
You're not prohibited. Yeah.
You're not prohibited.
And is it Judson from?
2 p.m., 2 to 6:30. We have theoretical discussions at the beginning of it. It's really nice. We should actually.
There's a lot of this.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.